to 9 p.m. Eastern on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Love, lust, and laughter. Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm your host, Dr. Diana Wiley, a board-certified sex therapist and a marriage and family therapist. Guests, colleagues, authors are interviewed, and we sometimes dispense advice to create a format that is both informative and entertaining. If you can't listen live, go to the archives and even rate the show on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope that you are coming with us.
This is PRN, the comprehensive news source for the world's progressive community. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Doug Rocky speaking to you from the snowy state of Illinois, and today we're going to continue on with our discussion about the Middle East and all the information. One thing that we have to learn is the information that we may have been taught in school, may have been taught during our military days, is sometimes quite different from what the truth is. Well, tonight we're going to continue on with the discussion in education. One thing, as we continue our discussion, I just want to give everybody a really good reference to go to. As everybody knows, the Smithsonian Institute is the primary institute of history and everything for the United States in Washington, D.C. Smithsonian Magazine publishes a lot of reports, and one of the most incredible reports I ever read was a Smithsonian Institute Magazine report called Inside Iran's Fury, published in October of 2008. Well, tonight we're going to talk a little about Iran and everything, and Patricia, are you there to help us?
I am, dear. How are you?
Well, I think we got a snow and ice storm barreling down on top of us from the weather report about 10 minutes ago.
It would appear that way. I'm Patricia Axelrod, and I conduct the Desert Storm Think Tank and All Veterans Advocate. And tonight we are pleased and honored to have two people joining us, two Iranian activists. They're with the group Havar. And Saman and Saba, are you with us?
Yes, we are.
Yes, hi.
Hello, hello. It's so good of you to join us. We'd like you to begin by telling us something about the group Havar and how it began.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for having us here on this show tonight. Well, Havar, the full name for the group Havar is Iranian Initiative Against War, Sanctions, and State Repression. And we basically started our group as very informal meetings that we, a group of very frustrated and concerned Iranians here in the city, in New York. We were based in New York. And it was February 2012 where there was lots of pro-intervention and pro-military attacks. The dialogue taking place in news and everywhere. And there was a anti-war demonstration taking place in New York on February 4th, 2012. So a group of us got together and we were wondering how we can have a presence in this demonstration. But many of us, we had the experience of the 2009 Iran experience, which after the election, there was this massive crackdown in the streets and like many people. People died, people went to prison, and there was a whole experience that we couldn't basically neglect, even though we are here in the U.S. So we very organically and very naturally took three slogans to this demonstration, which was no war, no sanctions, no state repression. It was very natural for us, but apparently, but the reactions that we got from different groups here in the street, but also later on social platforms, It was very shocking and interesting for us because we realized that there is definitely the need for having a position like this in the larger anti-war movement that basically holds the U.S. and Iranian government both accountable for the repression of Iranian people and everywhere in the world. So we continued our group. We formed many events. We started petitions, campaigns in order to basically broaden this the position that we have. I mean, basically, the main principle of ours comes down to social justice from below, basically, which means connecting grassroots struggles, understanding how they relate to each other. We in our group, it's not only Iranians right now. We have Iranians, Americans, Israelis, and Iraqis. And this is a very, very unique space and valuable for us because it allows dialogue between many different people from different backgrounds in order to create kind of a political demand, basically.
It would seem as though people here in this country in particular are, by and large, wholly uninformed about Iran and the country and the people of Iran. Would you agree with that? I guess that's what you were experiencing when you said you were rather dismayed following the demonstration, yes?
Yes, yes. I can go more detail into that. Well, yes, we were shocked because we realized that people didn't many people here didn't know the experience of the 2009 Green Movement in Iran, and they were, I mean, we were told that we are pro-Iranian government because we say no war, because we say no war, no sanctions. That means we are pro-Iranian government. But then on the other hand, we have people here that they were like supporters of the Iranian government, which they told us, why do you say no state repression? You shouldn't involve state repression with war and sanctions. So, but this was our whole argument. That was saying basically we got attacked from two different directions. One saying you're pro-Iranian government and one saying you're pro-American government. So we were basically trying to denounce both of these arguments by bringing all these struggles together, basically.
And what was the Green Movement in Iran, and is it still going over there?
Well, the way that we initiated it, it's not continuing, and it's not taking place in the street. But the Green Movement was basically a whole series of uprisings and demonstrations and protests that took place in after the election in 2009 in Iran. Because people voted for Amir Hossein Mousavi, which was one of the candidates, and many young people and supported him in his campaigns and in his dialogues and his language. But so there was a real hope that this person is going to be elected. But when the result came out, people were very disappointed because everybody had hopes in Mir Hossein Mousavi. And then people came to the streets with the slogan of, where is my vote? Basically, people felt that their vote has been stolen from the government there. And it basically started from then, and it continued for like 8-9 months actively in the streets. Every public holiday was a religious or normal public holiday was taken advantage of in order for people to show their presence again and continue their demand. But this is one of the things that we wanted to talk about today, how the Green Movement is kind of continuing.
And the reason they call it the Green Movement is because Mousavi, so the candidate who's actually currently, he and his wife, Rahnavard, and also another candidate who was also supporting them, Karibi, are all under house arrest. So the color of his campaign was green. So the color green became sort of a symbolism for the supporters of Mousavi. And it went beyond supporting Mousavi. So a lot of people, maybe they use that as an excuse to go out in the streets, but it was really a way for Iranians to reclaim public space and to fight for democracy, fight for political freedom, and a better future. So that's why they call it the Green Movement.
One thing I might want to come in here for a moment, just so our listeners are aware, and I mean not everybody even understands the geography. Iran sits between Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Iraq is obviously to the west. Afghanistan and Pakistan are to the east. You got the Soviet republics, Turkmenistan, and everything to the north, along with the Caspian Sea. And then you got the whole John Gulf along your southern border. So, right along the Gulf right there is on the southern border of Iran. The other thing, too, again, coming back to history, Iran has been a sovereign nation since antiquity. I mean, it was one of the nations goes back, ancient Persia, going back, forever and ever and ever. And, again, so Iran was sitting there, and at the same time, when the United States and Great Britain intervened in Iran after World War II, you guys had just elected a full democratic government, and then the U.S. and Great Britain, again, continuing on with the work that they're doing for all the resources, basically started Iran on a horrible path then after World War II. Isn't that correct?
Yes. Unfortunately, that history is also not as well known in the United States. I think the CIA actually declassified a lot of those files. And so now it came out in the news a couple months ago. So maybe hopefully people are more aware of this history that it's true the United States did actually engineer a coup d'etat against the prime minister of Iran at the time. And so they reinstalled the Shah. If we want to also go forward, we get to the Iranian Revolution of 1979. And the hostage crisis and those are all the things that have happened over the last 50, 60 years that have caused relations between the two countries to be soured to this point. Those are all important facts.
It would seem as though, unfortunately, it is this same motivation and this and an unresolved anger that many people have arising from the hostage situation, which is in fact, I should say, influencing the politics of today. Would you say that's true?
Well, many of these sanctions started immediately after the revolution and during the hostage crisis. But until 3 years ago, these sanctions are continuing, but in a very different form and different intensity. Since President Obama has been elected here, he's been introducing a whole new range of sanctions, which basically involve the entire economy of the country, Iran as a country. So. Basically, the entire import-export, the currency situation has been affected by the sanctions. So when some people argue here that these sanctions are targeted and they don't affect the population of the larger population, that is a very, very false claim to make because people basically rely on economy like any other country. And once the economy is basically restricted or it's basically narrowed down to very, very, very tight avenues for transaction, this means that people don't have economic leverage inside the country. So their life in many aspects gets restricted. So this is one way that this trauma of the past has been continuing the sanctions, but recently it has intensified so much that this is one reason that sanctions has been the focus of Hawar because of the intensity of it during the Obama administration.
So the sanctions under President Obama have become more severe and more restrictive? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely. So as Salman noted, there have been sanctions against, for example, after the revolution, there were sanctions against certain individuals who were in the Iranian state, so perhaps some ministers or people who were part of the Revolutionary Guard, but it was only to the point of, for example, freezing their assets abroad But these sanctions that were instituted in 2011, 2012 are actually much, much more stringent. So, for example, one thing that happened, it actually caused the collapse of the Iranian currency, the rial. So the currency was actually devalued by 80%. So when that happens, that means, for example, the dollar is now 3 or 4 times what it used to be, let's say, back in 2009 or 2010. So that means that a lot of things that people want to buy, a lot of just ordinary household items, things that are imported that Iran doesn't make itself, they all become, you know, 3 times, 4 times more expensive than they used to be. So, you know, there's inflation, there's people can't even afford simple, like, food items. You know, you want to buy your milk and your rice. I mean, these all become increasingly more and more expensive for people. And another thing that happened is that the U.S. Government is punishing all countries and companies that are doing business with Iran. So, and as I think most people know, Iran's main export is oil. I mean, that's what the economy is based on. So when it can't export its oil or get the revenues for it, then that means that it doesn't, it throws off the budget. That means that it doesn't have any revenue. The United States also sanctioned the Central Bank of Iran. And actually, one important fact to know is that these sanctions, I mean, it's the United States and it's the, you know, some of the European countries. But one thing that happened that was actually the first in history of sanctions, because we know, for example, South Africa, Cuba, like these countries also have sanctions against them. But one thing that did happen in the case of Iran, which was very bizarre, was that there non-governmental organization SWIFT, which is a banking organization, I'll explain it, but they actually sanctioned Iran as well. So SWIFT is it's a non-governmental organization, and it basically facilitates all financial channels, international financial channels. So like all banks have a SWIFT number. So like if you want to transfer, if you want to do a wire transfer from abroad, you have to find the SWIFT number for, you know, the bank that you're sending and getting money from. So when SWIFT dropped Iranian banks, that means that basically Iran's central bank and all the state banks can't do any transactions with any other entities abroad. So, I mean, this is the reason that, for example, now Iran couldn't pay for the medicine that they want to import. So Iran makes a lot of its own medicine, but there are some medicines that obviously are made by European companies or American companies, and they're usually for advanced diseases like cancer, MS, hemophilia. So they can't pay for those. That's why they can't import them. So now there's a shortage of medicine. So these are things that are directly affecting people's lives.
On an everyday basis. Yes, I'm sorry, Doug.
Well, I'm going back to the Smithsonian article and everything and reading. My knowledge of Iran is very limited. But when I look at the stuff as reported in the Smithsonian, basically Iran, the British controlled through the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, basically all of the Iranian oil assets. And when your government, after World War II, again, your democratically elected government came up and said, wait a minute, time out. This is ours. It's not yours to tell us what to do. So we're sitting there at a fundamental problem where Iran, as a nation of itself, going to an antiquity where you have everything going. I mean, if I understand correctly, Iran was a seat of education and information and research and everything going back to antiquity. And yet the British and the United States and the French wanted so much control there that everything just got totally tossed into the winds. And then what happened is the Iranians, in any action that the Iranian government took, was somehow deemed to be totally wrong. I mean, am I missing something here? Or is that kind of what happened? I mean, I'm trying to summarize it, but to me it's scary.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, that's absolutely true. I mean, this is sort of the story of the colonized world in general. I mean, Iran wasn't officially colonized, for example, like India, but it was still under the imperialist powers at the time. And it's true that British Petroleum, BP, actually used to be the Anglo-Iranian oil company. I mean, this is like during the time of the Shah. This is before the revolution, obviously. And this is when the Anglo-Iranian oil company, or AIOC, controlled most of the company. And I think Iran only had 16% of the revenue. So most of the revenue actually went to the British to the British, and very little of it actually went to the Iranian states. So that's why the prime minister in 1953, Prime Minister Mossadegh, he nationalized the oil, and that's why the MI6 from Britain, the CIA, they engineered the coup against him. So, I mean, this is a story of, you know, what we call sort of the developing world, the third world or colonized world. I mean, this has been happening all over. When we come sort of to the present day, you know, the 21st century, we sort of see a more complicated politics also happening because imperialism is still out there. Obviously, we saw it with the U.S. invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's still happening. You know, that you have these multinational corporations that are completely exploiting workers all over the world. But then you have also these sort of, you know, post-colonial governments that are also in cahoots with a lot of these multinational corporations, or, you know, they're still repressing their own people. So, I mean, this is where our organization sort of tries to, update the leftist politics of the 20th century, is that saying, yes, we're against imperialism, we're against war and sanctions, which are hurting the people, but we're also going to hold these governments accountable, because the government or the state itself, for example, the Iranian state, is also repressing its people. So we have to sort of fight on all fronts.
But it does seem as though, as you discussed the demonstrations that took place during the Green Movement, the origin of the Green Movement and so forth, it seems as though there is a greater political freedom in Iran now than in the past. Is that correct?
In the past, are you referring to before President Rouhani being elected?
Well, I guess I'm going back to the time of the Ayatollah post-Shah, when it was perhaps more repressive, certainly more repressive than now.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely... So one thing that we also need to keep in mind is that before the revolution, during the Shah's time, there was definitely political repression, and, you know, a lot of leftists who fought against the Shah, fought against imperialism, you know, they went to jail or they were exiled. Just at the moment of the revolution, there was really a space where a lot of different factions were both in conflict but also in dialogue. So, you know, there were socialists, there were liberal national, like secularists, and then there were the religious factions. So there was really actually a fight at the time of the revolution. But also one thing that happened, which, you know, maybe it's unique to Iran after the revolution, is that there was the Iran-Iraq War. So when the war happened in 1980, which is only a year after, 79, the revolution, I mean, that really, it really squeezed a lot of, you know, the potential for more, like, democratic movements or more protests, because, you know, people as young as 15, 14 were being sent to the front to fight with Saddam Hussein's army. So, I mean, that the 8 years of war really sort of depleted Iran, I mean, in terms of, you know, its energy and in terms of just that energy that had sprung from the revolution. So, I mean, that's something that also really affected both people's general mood, the mood of the nation. You know, there's a lot of, obviously, mourning for, you know, the martyrs of the war and the veterans of the war.
It was basically a moment to, like, boost up nationalism also, which we kind of, I don't want to say just suffer, but many movements have been affected by this sense of nationalism. And what something that gives more legitimacy to the Iranian government is its anti-imperial position. Basically, the Iran Revolution is at its core, it was an anti-imperialist revolution, which now it's one reason that it crushes its own movements internally, basically, because it's being legitimized, the position that Iranian government takes as the global anti-imperial leader of the Middle East and also of the whole world. So people think that there shouldn't be any social movement going on there, like, especially the hardcore anti-war groups here that when we say we want to hold the Iranian government accountable, they say, oh, why? The U.S. government is the evil. Well, we don't, in terms of scale, yes, maybe the U.S. government in terms of scale of influence in the world is different, but I don't think there's a space to prioritize any form of repression over the other one. Like, we basically have to fight all forms of repression, whether internal, external, imperial, local, all these things. These are all struggles that we have to fight at once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one thing about, just quickly, about also, for example, U.S. imperialism. I mean, Doug noted, is that Iran is right between Afghanistan and Iraq, two countries that, you know, the U.S. recently invaded. And so the Iranian people and also Iranian diaspora, they were very much right in being afraid that Iran was going to be next. You know, this is especially during the Bush administration. There was really a fear that, you know, Israel or the United States was going to attack. But actually, after the U.S. attacked Iraq, which, you know, we and our allies, we completely opposed any sort of invasion and occupation. You know, we have to also, like, when we talk about to Iraqi activists, they say that, you know, they're fighting against U.S. occupation. But they said that actually we have two occupiers. There's also Iran, because Iran as a state, you know, the state of Iran is also meddling in the affairs of Iraq now that for Saddam Hussein is gone. So, I mean, these are all the, so what we're trying to do as a grassroots organization is connect to these groups. So we want to connect to groups that, you know, the Iraqi, like, civil society and the, you know, the people in diaspora who are fighting against both, like, U.S. occupation and different forms of, like, sectarianism and all those other problems. I mean, this is what we're, you know, same with Syria, since we're sort of staying in the region, you know, like, the Syrian uprising was actually one of those, you know, the people's movement that then got hijacked, both by the United States, by, you know, Bashar Assad himself crushed the entire movement, and then the Iranian state is also trying to affect it, Russia, China, European powers, all the Gulf countries who are putting all this money to sort of bolster, like, the anti-Assad military groups were operating there. So, I mean, these are things that we have to keep in mind, is that the states are trying to hijack these movements. And so we as people, as if we really want to remain grassroots, is that we have to criticize all of them and try to form connections amongst people, not with governments.
How many people do you think like you do in Iran? What is what is the person on the street thinking, the average person?
They're definitely happy that the President Rouhani has been trying to reduce the effect of sanctions on Iran economy. And because for like almost 3-4 years, there was this depression inside the country that basically because of a bad economy, which was mostly caused by sanctions, but not all. We also have like very, very bad corruption and mismanagement inside the country, but we've had that for years. But during the last 3 years, we experienced a totally different form of economic repression. So now they're happy that there are some potentials for like better economy. And President Rouhani has released a number of political prisoners, including the female lawyer Nafshin Sotoudeh. So there are some spaces of hope and potential, but we all know that we can't just rely on these kind of small potentials, and we always have to push for more. And this is one aspect of criticism that Hawar as a group has towards the recent negotiations taking place, and the discourse of diplomacy that is taking place in media these days. And of course, nobody wants war, nobody wants poverty, but we believe that movements are being crushed between two different options: either war and poverty destruction, or diplomacy, state diplomacy. But we genuinely believe that there is definitely an alternative option in the middle, and that's people's movement. People pushing their social agendas, their economic agendas into the discourse of these states. And so we don't want to only rely on diplomacy taking place between President Obama and President Rouhani, but we have to push and challenge and critique these diplomacies as they're continuing. But definitely inside Iran, there's hopes of better situations to come.
Now, come back to the fundamentals in Iran. Iran has got a population of, what, about 70 million people today. It's a little bit smaller than the size-wise in the state of Alaska. What are the educational levels and what types of industry and agriculture exist in Iran that needs to be promoted?
And let's just, before we go on, remind the listeners that there has just been an agreement made, a diplomatic deal has been made between the U.S. and Iran that would ensure that Iran will not develop nuclear weapons. Although Iran has always stated that it has no interest in the development of nuclear weapons, but it is in fact that fear of Iran's ability to develop a nuclear weapon, which has allegedly been the driving force behind President Obama's more stringent sanctions. So I just thought I'd get that out there.
Also, the other thing, too, and I have to come back because, again, primarily our show is a lot of veterans. All of us were definitely in Iraq at one time or another, either Desert Storm or everything, and then it's totally common knowledge and, you know, in the U.S. Senate reports and been on television, talked on this radio show, that the United States absolutely gave Iraq the chemical biological weapons that were then used on Iran during that Iran-Iraq war in the 80s. Totally gave those to them that then Iraq then turned and used on us during Operation Desert Storm that we then destroyed and spread all over the place. So, I mean, that in itself to me is, I mean, this got to be a barn burner when the Iranians know, wait a minute, the U.S. attacked Iraq now, but during the Iran-Iraq war, the U.S. gave Iraq the chemical and biological weapons that they used on the Iranians. It called horrific casualties on all sides. And then, I mean, to me, the logic on all of this stuff is so bewildering that I can't figure it out.
Yeah, well, I guess starting with just some basic information about Iran. Yeah, I think the population is like 75 million. It's what you stated. Yeah, I mean, in terms of Iran has definitely been able to develop a lot, especially after the Iran-Iraq War. So there has been a lot of, you know, there has been a lot of development. It's definitely, Iran was sort of on its way to becoming more and more, you know, not just technologically advanced, but also become self-sufficient in a lot of industries. Because what happens, again, is, you know, from history, a lot of these older, like, colonized or third world countries, the economic relations just sort of follow even after, like, decolonization. So that country still becomes the exporter of the raw material, whereas, you know, the United States or Europe, they're still the ones who are producing, like, the technological advancement. So Iran has definitely made a lot of strides in that sense, you know, like, in terms of education, definitely. I mean, more and more people are going, like, millions of people go to university and they have bachelor's degrees or they, you know, they go on to go master's and PhDs. Women, actually, I think 60% of all university students are actually women. So it's definitely, Iran has a lot of infrastructure in that sense, and there's a lot of potential. But, you know, just as any development, you know, everywhere in the world, there are people who benefit and then there are the marginalized, the people who are left behind. So, yes, there's obviously definitely poverty in Iran. There are a lot of communities that haven't been as well served as, like, some of the, like, inner, like, urban areas. Especially we see this in a lot of, like, ethnic communities. And just to give a really quick breakdown, Iran is about, like, 50% of Iran's population are Persian, or Fars, we call them Fars. And then the other 50% are sort of a mix of different ethnicities. So there are Baluch, which are in the southeast, bordering by Pakistan. There are the Kurds, the Azeri Turks, there are Arabs, there are Turkmen, Lurs. So there are a lot of different ethno-lingual groups. And so those, the ones that are on the margins have been sort of the ones that were left behind in these development schemes. To go back to the what Patricia brought up, which was about the nuclear agreement, so we are obviously, and I know a lot of like Iranians are happy that an agreement did happen. And one reason that we're happy is that, you know, it sort of reduces the possibility of war. It reduces the possibility of, you know, perhaps Israel attacking Iran or Iran being forced to go into conflict. So, I mean, that's definitely a very positive outcome. But what we have to keep in mind is that, you know, per this agreement, Iran is actually agreeing to halt enrichment of uranium to like less than 5%, and they have to open all their nuclear facilities to the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency. And that's not actually, that's not just their nuclear plants, but all mines, like uranium mines, all the centrifuge facilities, like basically everything that is connected to this. And you're absolutely right that Iran has maintained that it doesn't have any intention of developing nuclear weapons. But what it's actually getting in return per this agreement is it's very limited. I mean, they're basically letting Iran keep its oil purchases to the level that it currently has, which is 60% less than it was 2 years ago. So it's still it's a very low level. And obviously they were talking about facilitating some sort of humanitarian transaction. Like a channel, like they want to set up a financial channel so like humanitarian aid, like food or medicine can get to Iran. I mean, that's still in the works, I think. I don't think it has been set up yet. So the total like relief for Iran comes at about $7 billion, which may seem like a lot of money, but when you actually compare it to the total foreign exchange holdings of Iran abroad, it's actually $100 billion. So this is 7%. So per this agreement, 7% of Iran's holdings have sort of been freed. So now they can sort of do something with that money. But we also have to keep in mind that this is not a significant reduction or lifting of sanctions. This is just, I mean, really minimal and basic. And also, I mean, as Havar, our goal is, obviously we don't want there to be any conflict in the Middle East, but we also realize that it's not just for Iran to not develop nuclear weapons, but that we also have to be critical of countries who do have nuclear weapons, especially in the Middle East. We know, like Israel, even though they haven't officially admitted to it, but everybody knows that they have nuclear weapons, and they're one of the major threats in the region. The United States itself has thousands of nuclear stockpiles. I mean, they have their nuclear arsenal. And basically every other country, I mean, Russia, China, the Great Britain, I mean, we're really sort of, not only do we not want Iran to have nuclear weapons, but we don't want anybody to have them. And we really think that all countries do have them, have to move toward disarmament.
This is what we're trying to push for in all of our actions and petitions, and that disarmament is good, but not for one, but for everyone, mm-hmm. all states.
And that sanctions are not a legitimate justification for just because the United States thinks that perhaps Iran might be developing nuclear weapons. I mean, that's sort of ostensibly the reason that they always present is that, oh, we are imposing sanctions, so Iran will come to the negotiating table and they'll stop with their nuclear enrichment, they'll stop developing nuclear weapons. I mean, that's something that they've been, you hear it a lot in the media, is that, oh, look what happened with this interim deal, the one that was just reached in November. We put all these sanctions on Iran, and then Iran came to the negotiating table. That's actually false, and we're always trying to sort of fight against this sort of misinformation. The deal that was reached is actually, in terms of the nuclear stuff, it's the same deal that they had drawn up, I believe it was back in, like, it was between, like, 2000 to, like, 2003. And that's actually when Rouhani was currently the president at the time. He was the nuclear negotiator for President Khatami's administration. So he and the European countries, they all came to this agreement, this exact agreement that we have now. But what happened was that when the United States joined the negotiations, at that time we were under Bush's administration, they completely rejected this plan. So this plan had already been drawn up, 10 years ago, but the U.S. completely rejected it. And then in 2005, in Iran, we had presidential elections where Ahmadinejad was elected for the first time. And that's when, obviously a lot of tensions happened. So Ahmadinejad's government also didn't want to negotiate as much. So then we had Bush, and then we had Ahmadinejad, like two very polarizing figures who didn't want to talk to each other. So what actually has changed now that we have this agreement is the fact that Obama has been elected president of the United States, and then Rouhani was elected just recently in June 2013. So it's not the sanctions didn't really work. I mean, that's sort of the reasoning everybody gives about sanctions. Like, oh, look, they worked. They brought Iran to the negotiating table. But that's actually not true. It's just that the governmental politics is what was changing.
And it would seem as though what was influencing the agreement this go-round was a threat of American boots on the ground there, war, in fact, American war against Iran. It seemed as though that was also in the air then.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in 2006, I think there was a lot of 2006, 2007, there was a lot of fear of an American invasion. In 2012, like Salman was saying earlier, and in 2012, that was also, if you remember, right after the Occupy Wall Street movement in the United States. So there was a lot of, energy and movement for, like, anti-war activism happening in the United States, not just, again, for Iran, but also for Iraq and Afghanistan and, all these other countries.
And one way that Hawar as a group came together with its diverse members was actually members attending like Occupy Wall Street meetings or more progressive grassroots movements that were taking place at that time, and we met people that then they decided to join Hawar. So these people are still attending Hawar, and as we are still one group. And what brings advantage to our group is this: the diversity. It's exactly the diversity that allows some sort of dialogue that we can't have outside in the real world, almost, because of all this media, false media, false information that's been given. Basically, the option of dialogue is being taken away from people. But when we do have dialogue, we don't want to have a naive dialogue. We want to have like a dialogue that is like complex, and it takes account all sorts of repression that is taking place in either Middle East, in the U.S., in South America, everywhere. We try to connect our causes to other causes, and people here in the U.S., people struggling against economic repression here, people struggling against racial profiling and all this stop and frisk and everything. We try to be engaged with all forms of like movements against repression.
And what do you think the willingness is of the current government in Iran to listen to you and to negotiate with people who would hope for and dream for a more democratic Iran?
I think that so one thing that we have to keep in mind with Iran is that usually in the Western media, Iran is always presented as this monolithic state entity, as if there's only like one person and he makes all the decisions. The supreme leader is usually presented as the dictator that makes all the decisions all by himself, but that's actually kind of a very stereotypical view, and it's actually not very correct. I mean, it's true that the supreme leader has a lot of power, especially when it comes to foreign policy or issues surrounding national security. But actually, Iran's politics is pretty complex. So there are definitely, different parties, political parties. There are different factions. There are interests. I mean, so it's sort of what you would see like in the United States. You have the Democrats, Republicans, and then you have the groups that maybe are more marginalized. Maybe like you have, the Green Party. You have Social Democrats, et cetera, et cetera. In Iran, it's also, it has that diversity as well. So, like, we really have to take the factional, you know, infighting and, like, the politics that happens within Iran seriously as well. One thing that we also want to sort of stress is that for a lot of people, the 2009 Green Movement, you know, obviously it was crushed very violently by the Iranian state. So if you just, for example, if you follow news of Iran, you may not hear anything of like massive street protests going on. And you may think, oh, well, the movement died. But that's actually not true. You may not see a lot of protests that are, you know, what we think of as protests, like holding banners going on the streets. So some of that is still happening a little bit. But actually a lot of organizations like nonprofits and civil rights activists, those are still operating and they're still fighting for their rights. And they are hopeful, as we mentioned before, that maybe the government is going to provide some sort of space for their activities to increase. And all the politics of Iran is actually sort of happening under the shadow of sort of the trauma of the Green Movement. And the best example of this is actually when Rouhani was elected and he was selecting his cabinet members. In Iran, just like in the United States, you know, the cabinet, the administration, the departments, they have to go in front of the Senate to be approved. So in Iran, it's the same thing. So the cabinet members, they go in front of the parliament of Iran, and, you know, the parliamentarians ask some questions, and then they have to be approved by a vote. And actually, the one issue that they all kept coming back to, and it caused such a huge controversy, was whether the nominee for the cabinet was somehow involved with the Green Movement or with the protests or with the, you know, reformists or the liberals or whatever. I mean, this shows, like, you may not see protests, but this really shows how much of an impact this movement has had on Iranian politics. And it's created an entire discourse. The Iranian state calls it fetneh, which in Persian translates to sedition. So they try to sort of call the protesters seditionists. So, I mean, that is like the one word that kept being thrown around. If you watch sort of Iran's version of C-SPAN, you would see this a lot when they were interviewing the nominees. I mean, this really shows that politics, I mean, street politics do matter, and, you know, state politics also matter.
How many political prisoners are there now in Iran, would you think?
Well, we don't need to think. We know the exact number, which is between 800 to 900.
And that includes, that's political prisoners, but that also includes, for example, some ethnic minorities, so people who are fighting for ethnic minority rights, or it includes, for example, religious minorities, like the Baha'i, and like human rights activists in general, like student activists, labor activists. I mean, that includes all of those, like prisoners of conscience.
Yeah, I think it's important to know how many political prisoners we have, but I think it's important to know the history of each one of these movements inside Iran and try not to generalize it as a one broad definition of political prisoner. Yes, they're all political, but the causes that they've been fighting for and the history of the women's rights movement has its own history, very, very different history from, for example, the ethnic minorities movement and the student movement. And I think it's important to like engage and learn about all these movements separately, as opposed to like think as all dissidents in Iran as political prisoners. Yes, they are political prisoners, but they have different demands, different causes, different histories, and different futures, I guess, unfortunately.
You're describing a very different Iran from that, though, that which is seen on the television or that which is normally portrayed by the media here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so Salman and I both grew up in Iran, but also we've kept a lot of our connections since we left. We, you know, obviously we try to keep in touch with the activists who are still in Iran, or they have, for example, just recently left because they couldn't continue their political activities. So we're trying to be as much, you know, in touch with what's going on the ground.
So what do you think is the future of Iran? Do you think that there will be the democracy that you hope for in Iran? Will that be happening anytime in the near future? Will it happen under this present government? What's your thoughts?
It's a very uncertain path that the movements are taking inside Iran, but we definitely have hope, and we see potentials, but we don't see potentials in the traditional sense of toppling the government or making a revolution and bringing in a new government. We think that we have to push and try our all of our options in like parallel, and that's why, as Sabo mentioned, that it's important to engage with internal politics of Iran and know where there are potentials to intervene as people and where to take advantage, because there are fractions. There are very much fragmentations inside the Iranian government also, and there's no hegemony of like one hardliner dictator, no. But there's very, very different fragments, and the reformers have been presented as the opposition movement for many years, but that has also been changing from time to time. And we know that we cannot rely only on reform either. So we cannot rely on anything that we think will give us the ultimate answer, because the ultimate answer basically rely on people's movements. And until they make their demands solid and they stand for it, nobody will give them what they want. That's the same everywhere, in the U.S. also, and everywhere in the world. We know that until people don't ask and they don't stand for it, nobody's going to give them the kind of freedom or the democracy that they imagine. So we really hope for the future of democracy that we imagine in Iran is not basically... we basically believe that there should be economic equality as the same as the U.S. We think that economic equality these days is one of the core demands of all movements, and we have to recognize that. That reformers coming to the power in Iran doesn't necessarily mean all the marginalized segments of Iran's society will be treated equally. So this is people's role. This is people's responsibility to make sure that everybody will have the same access to all resources.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously it's a very complicated question, and you can never foretell what's going to happen in the future. But I would say that I also generally agree with Salman. I mean, what we really need is a sort of bottom-up, like, social justice movement. The reformists, I mean, in Iran, if you wanted to sort of break it down to two main camps, you have the conservative or the principalists, they call them, and then you have the reformists. The reformists are sort of the more liberal, you know, politically they're the more liberal of the two. But they also push or want to continue sort of neoliberal economic policies, which obviously leaves a lot of, you know, marginalized and poor communities behind. So what we really need is, you know, economic justice. We need to lift, I mean, obviously the United States needs to lift all the sanctions so that the economy can function again, and so people will have the opportunity to actually go out in the streets and protest for their rights. But if they're always going to be kept hungry and they're all going to have to work three different jobs just to make ends meet, they're not going to have time to go and you know, protest or to care about, you know, their city council elections or like their parliament elections. So, I mean, all these issues are connected to each other.
This is what goes on here in the United States. This is why our nation has never reached the potential that it should have and could have, because of the fact that people are preoccupied with just the very existence of life.
Definitely, and like if you look, for example, look at the Occupy movement in the United States, you know, some people say, well, Occupy failed because it didn't manage to, for example, topple the capitalist regime in the United States, but actually it had a huge impact on the discourse. I mean, now we have discourse of the 99% and the 1%. It created a whole series of dialogue, and it actually brought a lot of groups together. So not all of these activists were all maybe before working on completely different issues, all came together and were talking to each other. I mean, that's the sort of thing that also happened with Iran's green movement in 2009, and it's what happened with the Arab Spring in different Arab countries. I mean, this is why we need social spaces and public spaces, and this is why we need social movements.
We're running down here. We've only got a couple, two, 3 minutes left. Is there any way our listeners can get additional information or contact your organization or find out about it?
Yeah, definitely. So we invite people to visit our website, and that's www.havar, that's HAVAAR.org. And there's a lot of information on there about sanctions, about, you know, the campaigns. We're based in New York City, so if people are interested in joining the organization, those who are based in New York, they can obviously contact us. And we really just, I would like to end this with telling, you know, your listeners and the American people to really support the progressive and grassroots movements here in the United States. I mean, even if it's not related to Iran, any sort of progressive, leftist and grassroots movements that are happening, it's really important to support those, and also to hold their congressperson and their senators accountable and call them and tell them to oppose sanctions, because as we know, Congress is conservative and they're trying to impose more sanctions. So, I mean, that's something we really want to push for.
Well, ladies, you know, thank you very, very much for coming on and discussing all of this. Again, the Progressive Radio Network, Warrior Connection, we're about education, information, and empowering you to gather and do the best that we can for the nation and the world. Well,
we
everybody,
hope
thank you very much.
We hope we've educated you tonight about Iran, though, and that you have a different picture of Iran and recognize that there is much happening there. And above all, when you hear the war drums beating for war in Iran, do what you can to stop it.
Well, thank you very
much. Thank you very much for having us here.
Yeah, thank you. Thank
please,
you.
Please come back on again and keep us updated.
Definitely. Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening.